Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush.
That's me.
We are here this week talking about UFC 300, and for once it doesn't feel like, I don't feel like I want to be distracted talking about a bunch of other stuff, you know?
I thought you were going to say, for once I don't want to kill myself.
No, that's ever present.
Oh, shit. Yeah, what do you mean by that? Distracted by other stuff.
The abyss always calls. I'm just being like, you know, usually we start the show out and it's just like, you know, whatever we've been talking about earlier that day,
Yeah.
Whatever else is going on. It's always sort of, you know, we could be talking about other stuff than this UFC card. We don't have to talk about main event last week?
It was Curtis Allen.
Oh, yeah, we don't have to talk about Curtis Allen, too.
Yeah, that's a little insight for the listeners who don't know that before we start recording, we do not start the call saying, so what do you think about this card?
No,
we're like, what you been watching?
Yeah.
Good. What's for dinner?
We, in fact, never actually discuss MMA outside of the talking on the show, really.
We'll do some gossip.
That's a little gossip, but like,
well, MMA gossip, a little complaining about MMA fans and personalities, a little bit of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're not breaking down fights in our free time.
No. This is an anti-prep show.
That's right. We watch footage though sometimes.
Yeah, no. I do the prep, but I'm just saying, like, we don't actually, you know, script
that it. It is prep to me. We didn't do it this time, and look how confused this intro is.
Yeah.
Usually we come in with some nice energy. Now we don't know what's happening.
I'm
bewildered.
I was hoping that the UFC 300 energy would just magically carry me. And
instead, this is possibly our worst intro ever.
That's why the main card Vivi is free, folks. The prelim, Vivi, that's the one where we're already warmed up. We've already done the main show.
That's the good stuff. We get warmed up. We're really clicking when we get to the bad fights.
Yeah. This is big stuff. Who cares about that?
So
this UFC 300 card is really good. You know? It's not, and I'll say this just for the sake of saying it, because it seems like it needs to be said. It's not special it's not creative in the way that UFC 1 and 200 were creative.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, and UFC 200 was a letdown ultimately, but you have to remember that it was supposed to be headlined by Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz.
Yeah.
And 2, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was supposed to be headlined by Jon Jones versus Daniel Cormier, too.
They tried
really hard to put a main event on top of that that was like as electric as UFC 100, having Brock Lesnar, Frank Mir, too.
Yeah, main events that felt like, would it have been Jones DC 1 or 2? I mean, both felt historic.
It was 2, I believe.
Yeah, two like really historic rematches with a ton of heat.
Yeah.
Going into them. That's the kind of move you expect. Here we just kind of have normal title defense title fights.
Yeah, very good title fights, but not exceptional.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have heard that they did try to do some stuff. They apparently tried to get Tom Aspinall a fight on this card. They tried to get Leon Edwards a fight on this card,
but even that would have been the same. You're just getting more fight, because the quantity of interesting, meaningful fights is perfectly up to snuff.
Oh yeah,
the card is absolutely littered with It's the blue name test on Wikipedia, yeah, and it's littered with blue names. Like, can't complain about that. It's just that, like,
it doesn't have that one out of left field. I hadn't even thought of this fight, or I've been thinking about this fight nonstop for the last 5 years.
Yeah. What's the tent pole? Really, it feels like Topuria Volkanovski should have probably been like the title fight for 300, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Something really historic, and
or had they not just rushed it to make it happen, being able to, and had it not been in the middle of Ramadan, being able to do Makhachev Volkanovski too. That would have been, had they saved it and given Volkanovski a full camp and
something like that, with a little more heat and emotional investment.
Yep. Honestly, too, like, you know, that Sean O'Malley, Chito Vera, he's become a highly recognized.
Yeah, that too. Honestly, I was looking forward to that one for as much as we were like, this isn't the title fight I'd like to see for the division. And certainly as it played out in hindsight, would have felt like a real coming of age moment for a new elite fighter. Like, instead we get two champions just sort of defending their belts.
Yep. Which is fine. Very good. Well-booked fights. And then a whole bunch of cool fights under it. So
Justin Gaethje, Max Holloway is the main event. Let's be honest. Like, that is the kind of fight that we're talking about. It's just not a title fight. So it can't be at the top.
Although that does mean that if I have to agree to that statement, I am also parroting an Ali Abdelaziz talking point for the week.
Oh, what's that?
That Justin Gaethje versus Max Holloway is the main event, except that it's not a title fight, so they had to put other fights over it.
Well, broken clock, you know.
Yeah,
I don't think he's wrong about that. Frankly, if they had put these two title fights on here and then used the excuse of the BMF title to make Gaethje Holloway the main event, I would not have been upset about that.
No, me either.
That's, to me, I think the biggest fight, and all of the serious MMA fans, like, I think that's the one everyone's most excited about for obvious reasons.
Yeah. I'm kind of also most worried about it.
Sure.
But, you know.
But that's part of it, right?
Yeah, that's part of it. That I am thrilling to see it happen. And It is definitely the most wild card fight on this card. Where it's like, oh man, I didn't expect them to book that fight. You know,
feels like something special.
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about the actual main event. Alex Pereira, Jamahal Hill, and it's good to see the massive light heavyweight mess that has been going ever since John Jones dropped the belt.
Mm-hmm.
Start to feel like it's going to get a little clarity again. Like, we already had Prochazka back. He fought Alex Pereira. Now we've got Jamahal Hill back. He's fighting Alex Pereira. At some point, we're going to get Jamahal Hill versus Yuri Prochazka in there, mm-hmm. I'm sure, too. And we're actually starting to get these five title contenders or so that we've had over the past couple of years, or even champions that we've had over the last couple of years, starting to get them all in the room together.
Man, Prochazka Hill, that's a fight night light heavyweight main event I'd actually want to see.
Yes, that would be an awesome fight.
And that sounds ridiculous.
It needs to happen in the next year. That's what I would say.
I would like to see that. But at least trying to establish some clarity. I mean, it really depends what happens here.
Sure.
I say that because Alex Pereira is, you know, always a bit vulnerable, is not a great defensive fighter, is not the most consistent strategic fighter, not because it isn't really easy to pick him here.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. This is a light heavyweight fight. It's an Alex Pereira fight. I think he really has a tendency to sort of take his eye off the ball at times. As a fighter, I think he can get really lazy on defense, especially considering he has really sort of going against the grain of what is sort of the meta for most MMA strikers, and leaning into the kind of patient, long range style.
Yeah.
Go on.
I was just going to say, I was talking a little bit, not even a whole conversation, but just a little bit about this on Twitter the other day with, with Lucas Bordone, you know, noted Wonder Boy lover, mm-hmm. Lucas Bordone.
Yeah, he runs the fan club.
He runs the fan club, and he was making a point that, like, people are, you know, sort of like, there's apparently some chatter among fans and probably pundits that Alex Pereira is, like, an all-time great combat sports athlete, like, just in general, because of his ability to be a great kickboxer and a great MMA fighter. And Bordone was making the case that I agree with, that, like, he's honestly kind of a wildly flawed fighter for how much he's accomplished.
Yeah.
You know, like, his accomplishments are certainly absolutely great, but, you know, his point was that there were several world-class opponents during his prime in kickboxing that Pereira either couldn't beat or wouldn't have beaten, probably for the bulk of his career, if not all of it.
Yeah.
And even in MMA, where he has done great things and discharged to two belts in a very short amount of time, it's still with a game that just has a lot of gaps.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I don't think it takes away from his greatness, really.
No.
Like, still, like, he is one of the most, I mean, he's right up there with Alistair Overeem.
Yeah.
As all-time great crossover credentials, like both guys who have, yeah, won titles in these two different sports. But nobody would say Alistair Overeem was, like, a perfect kickboxer or MMA fighter either.
No.
even the Uberim version had some really obvious flaws. Pereira is very much in that mold.
Yeah,
and it creates interest in every one of his fights, honestly, because, like I said, if I look at this from a, you know, I'm evaluating the fighter's technical skill,
uh-huh.
It's so easy to pick Pereira.
Yeah, there was a moment I was watching tape for this, and it was like the I have to make my mind up for who I'm going to pick moment.
Uh-huh.
Where I was watching Jamal Hill fight Glover Teixeira, and there was a moment where he had Glover backed against the cage, and he threw the same rear hand uppercut four times in a row, just flash a jab, throw the uppercut, flash a jab, throw the uppercut, flash a jab, throw the uppercut, flash a jab, throw the uppercut.
Yeah.
And all I could think about was Tito Ortiz boxing Anderson Silva. Where his brain just got stuck and he was only trying to throw, like, the one left hook over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And it is the kind of thing that it's just like, well, I can't see that and then not pick Alex Pereira.
I mean, shit, I was thinking if this was the Glover Teixeira who fought Ryan Bader, Jamal Hill will be knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
Or Bader did that shit. He had Glover hurt, threw the same right hand four times in a row. Fourth time, got killed.
Yeah.
Jamal Hill is that's a decision making thing, which is its own thing. I think, frankly, he's a better intuitive decision maker by far than he is a technician, though. Like, You've got right idea, wrong execution in a lot of fighters, like Manny Pacquiao. A lot of right idea, wrong execution. The ideas were so right, the execution didn't matter.
Yeah.
And certain fighters get away with that all the time. Max Holloway is one. Like, Max Holloway will make all kinds of technical mistakes, but he's in so much in command of the fight that, you know, he's make those are considered decisions. He's like, okay, I'm not going to worry about keeping my feet in order or whatever in this spot, because this dude is just shelled up in response to this feint. I'm going to lunge him so I can nail him.
Yeah.
Jamal Hill is perhaps the purest right idea wrong execution fighter ever. Not in that his ideas are so right, but because his execution is so very wrong.
Yes.
He literally does not have striking technique.
Man, I saw him on social media the other day. Somebody had posted a video of like why Jamal Hill sucks, basically. And if you know anything about Jamal Hill on social media, it could be a one follower account.
Yeah.
With like a SpongeBob meme with Jamal Hill's face on it, and he would still spend like a day responding just to that.
Which is really funny when you then see the footage of him like asking for Alex Pineda's autograph and hugging him behind stage before their actual fight.
Yeah.
He gets way more worked up about nobody's.
Yeah. But you know, and it was a bunch of Jamal Hill wading in with his chin up, held high, and looking for a 1-2 or a uppercut or some other, you know, really loading up on his backhand kind of strike and just getting popped for it. And Hill was like, oh, no. All of those shots you see, I'm rolling away from all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you in like the Anderson Silva, Chris Weidman sense, sure.
You're cringing away from them. I'm not sure
if that
really counts as rolling the punches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are in a division. You are in a division where, you know, this is footage of you against noted sharp form punchers like Tiago Santos and Johnny Walker and Paul Craig and Ovince St. Preux. Not one of those men can throw a tidy hook.
Right.
At all. You know?
A consistent jab, for example. Or consistent
jab, yeah.
Yeah, like, the most basic elements of boxing, yeah.
The fact that you are maybe starting to flinch away from something and it's not well executed enough to hit you as clean as it should,
yeah,
is not a reflection of your great defense.
Yeah. Yeah. Jamal Hill has tactical awareness, but yeah, none of the technique to back it up.
Yeah.
You know, he can see a shot coming. He can see openings and create setups. He can counter. But on a technical level, like for most of any fight he's in, Jamal Hill's footwork simply does not exist.
Yeah.
I'm not like overstating the case there. Like, uh-uh. He just walks around. He crosses his feet constantly. He brings his feet really close together constantly. He's flat-footed. And he is just horribly out of position, like, all the time.
Yep.
And it honestly, it is a testament to how good of a fighter Jamal Hill is that he has such a winning record against. I mean, you can knock those opponents. It's not like that's, you know, beating absolute cans.
Oh, no. These are all very good, credible opponents. They're right. It's a
testament to how innately good at fighting Jamal Hill must be that he's been so successful against all these different varied opponents with like a maybe like 30% being generous of like a technical kickboxing game at his disposal.
He's also, I mean, and a lot of that too is it's got to be said, he is really fast.
Yeah.
For a man big, his size.
He's big, he's really fast, and he's got big power. And he's also tough as hell. Like he has all of these qualities. And like I said, he does that does sort of underscore the fact that he does have a feel for fighting. Like there's no way he could get to this point with his technique being as genuinely terrible as it is without just sort of naturally being a good fighter.
Mm-hmm.
But all those technical flaws are really the kind of things that the kinds of thing that you don't necessarily see exploited until you fight somebody who is like a kickboxer.
Yeah, I mean, we like Sean Strickland has a lot of the same flaws that Hill does.
Right. But against most of his opponents, he's like a defensive savant.
Exactly. And then he fought Alex Pereira.
Yeah.
And just got flatlined.
Brings his feet close together, reaches for punches, chin high up in the air. And yeah, Pereira's like, oh, okay, I'll just make you do that and then knock you out.
Yep.
Yeah, that this is the thing, is that Pereira has lapses. Like I said, he gets really lazy on defense. I think that's one of the biggest flaws for him with this new style. A bit like Justin Gaethje. Like, uh-huh. He's adopted a style which encourages pressure, but it's a bit of a bluff.
Yeah.
Like, when somebody really, really pressures him, he gets into trouble. Mm-hmm. Pretty much every time.
Yeah, no.
Whether it's Adesanya, whether it's Yuri Prochazka, just like Gaethje, like he wants people to walk into his counters. But when Khabib and Charles Oliveira were like, okay, he got into trouble. It's not actually what he wanted. That's sort of Pineda's problem. But in every respect, he is far superior technically. His footwork is much better. I would say his footwork is better now than it was when he was a kickboxer.
Mm-hmm.
He just stays over his feet. He stays nice and balanced. He's pretty light on his feet. Again, surprising for a guy his size that you could say that about him, but he is quite light on his feet most of the time these days.
Uh-huh.
Does know how to throw a jab, just like Gaethje. Really wish he would use it more because it's a great shot.
It would be great to see just for how, like, he's pared his game down to such a small selection of tools that he regularly uses.
Yeah.
And the effectiveness in a lot of ways is insulated by how big, fast, and powerful Pineda is. It would be really good to see him just be like, no, you don't have to just insulate yourself with the physical tools.
Right.
You could insulate yourself with a few more technical tools as well.
Yeah. Yeah. But if he's a little tactically limited, he's still technically pretty sharp.
And, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, because he has solid footwork, he's pretty good at moving around the outside. Like, you do actually have to make most light heavyweights will have to make mistakes in order to track him down.
Uh-huh.
And Jamal Hill can't track anybody down without making mistakes. Like, it's his game is mistakes. That's his whole game is mistakes.
Yeah.
Is that you remember that old Unforgivable video? I just want to make a meme where it's just Jamal Hill, like a YouTube poop, where it's just a Jamal Hill fight for 25 minutes, where every single time he makes any move at all, you cut to the guy saying, bitch, that's a mistake. It would be a 5-hour long video where you're just constantly cutting to that. So, yeah, he is going to get – I think he's going to have a very difficult time, Jamal Hill, dealing with Pineda's low kicks, as basically everybody does. Even Jan Blachowicz, who's like the only light heavyweight who knows how to check low kicks, because Pineda, again, something he didn't really do as a kickboxer. I think that's a real testament to Pineda's greatness and the fact that he has been able to make it in these two sports. Like, he learns shit and adapts his game really adeptly.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't really a low kicker, and he also, like, he didn't have great low kick defense. He tended to ignore them. And then in the Adesanya fights, it's like he's out kicking Adesanya for long stretches and checking his low kicks, just like Blachowicz did. But he's really sneaky. He has like a no-tell calf kick,
uh-huh,
which is still tremendously powerful and damaging. And it works great against everybody he throws it at. It's going to work especially great, I think, against the skinny-legged, flat-footed, stumbling Jamal Hill.
Yeah.
Seriously, like, he's going to have a problem dealing with those kicks. He's heavy, somehow equally heavy on both feet at all times.
Remarkable.
And
that's one of those tables at a restaurant where, like, it wobbles.
You prop up one leg and it still wobbles.
Exactly.
Yeah, somebody needs to, like, do a like do four folds of a napkin and stick it under both of Jamal Hill's heels.
Yes. Just, somehow the table wobbles, and yet the only way to make it not wobble is to shim it the exact same under all sides. Yeah. And like you've got the exact same amount of shim under each foot, and somehow now it doesn't wobble.
Yeah. Jamal Hill's cutman should be his cutman should be equipped with four packs of matches. Just duct tape him to Jamal Hill's feet at some point in the fight. Suddenly his footwork looks amazing. That's going to be a particularly difficult weapon for him to deal with. He's going to have a hard time, I think, tracking Pineda down without overextending. But like I said, Jamal Hill has a feel for landing his strikes. He is big and fast and powerful. Yep. He can take a shot, and Pineda is anything but defensively perfect.
Yes.
So like and... this will still be a dicey fight for Pineda. It's a good thing it's light heavyweight, because otherwise this would be a much more boring pick to make, I think.
Yes. It does have to be said, too, that while he's not a great wrestler, and he's not a good grappler at all, Hill is a very strong ground and pound striker.
Oh yeah.
Really ferocious with his ground and pound, and Alex Pereira's game off of his back is very much just hold and wait.
Like a lot of these sort of technically ponderous punchers in MMA, once you're actually like stuck in a place where Jamal Hill is already touching you,
yeah,
his power becomes a huge problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there are going to be several avenues for Hill to just go out there and detonate Pereira. But if that doesn't happen, he's not in a great position to win any single striking battle. And he's dealing with somebody who has also got the form and technique pretty much like never before, nobody he's had to face before, to really make him pay for all of his problems. I mean, unquestionably to this point, Glover Teixeira is the most technical striker that Hill has ever faced.
Yeah, and it was a Glover Teixeira right on the cusp of an already very late retirement.
Yeah, it was 43-year-old Glover Teixeira.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, you know, we have late career Thiago Santos, who is the definition of back foot inactivity and a good kicker, but very much in that like Jackson Wink mode of let me warm myself up for 1 minute to try one weird trick. And then you've got Johnny Walker, who in the midst of his, you know, identity crisis. And Jimmy Crute, Paul Craig, Ovince St. Preux, Clidson Abreu, Darko Stosic.
Yeah.
It's really a list of people that are not well suited to strike with Jamal Hill. You know?
Yep. It's not exactly a murderer's row of kickboxing talent.
No. And that for a division that has some very good strikers in it, you know, this is kind of the first real big test for Hill of like, okay, if we put you in there against somebody like Ankalaev, Pereira, Blachowicz.
Shit, do we think Jamal Hill would have an easy fight with Dustin Jacoby?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or Rakic. No, I don't think he would with any of these. He has somehow sort of avoided a lot of the actual somewhat decent kickboxers.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think you have to pick Pereira. Just like I said, that there was that moment watching tape where he just throws the same rear uppercut four times in a row. And you know how many of those he landed? Zero.
Yeah.
Not one.
This is, and, I mean, this is a thing that happens in a lot of Potato fights. This is very much the kind of fight where he could sting Potato.
Yeah.
Get him to go defensive and then get nuked trying to hurt him, trying to put him away.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big, big center point of Potato's game as well. It's just have the left hand always ready for the, even, sometimes it even just looks like a swiping left hook from him. And it's always just, it's so accurate, and he's so long and rangy on that punch that he can snap it out, and it just ruins people.
And just like with his kicks, Potato does not have to load up. He has naturally huge power.
Yeah.
He's just one of those guys. He's got long limbs and the big ass hands. And he can just throw a short little left hook or a short little uppercut. I mean, the left hook is the shot the commentators fixated on in his knockout of Prochazka.
Mm-hmm.
But what completely set Prochazka up to be unable to withstand that was the right uppercut, which sort of just caught him on like the neck.
Yeah.
Like the side of the jaw. But you could see didn't even land clean, a glancing blow. And it had such thudding power with Prochazka running into it. That it completely knocked him off balance. He's just, you don't want to be forgetting your defense standing right in front of Potato trying to put him away.
Yeah, and there's no version of Jamal Hill that gets in kill mode that remembers what defense is. I mean, he's not a defensive fighter at any time.
Right.
But when he is trying to finish somebody, or when he thinks he can really press his advantage, it is absolutely defense out the window.
Yeah. And I think this will be fun because I think Jamal Hill is going to start getting his legs chewed up and have to go for it, just like Prochazka. Uh-huh. I think that will invariably lead to some exciting exchanges, and very likely Potato will get hurt again.
Yeah.
But you just have to pick Alex.
Yep. Potato opened at -158, is currently at -123, so those odds slowly trending closer and closer. Hill opened at +142, currently down to +111. I get it. I still just think that Potato should be a reasonable favorite. But it does not feel like a fight where it feels like a fight where somebody's getting knocked out. And that could end up coming at a moment where both guys are hurt and they are both like a half second from landing that one detonating punch that knocks the other guy out. And you're just betting on who wins the battle there to land first. All right, that brings us to a woman's strawweight title fight, Weili Zhang against Xiaonan Yan.
I've always said Yan Xiaonan.
I've always said Yan Xiaonan as
but I guess
well.
By that, but I guess then it should be Zhang Weili.
Then it should be Zhang Weili, yeah. It's just one of those unfortunate things with Chinese and Korean and Japanese fighters where somebody starts calling them one thing when they first jump over, and it is so hard to actually correct and figure out.
Yeah, I think in all those countries, like the surname is like the use name in polite conversation, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And a lot of Japanese fighters, especially, really confuse the issue because they just start going by only one name.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. Well, forgive us our ignorance, Asian MMA fans.
Weili Zhang, Xiaonan Yan, and you know, if
another one,
yeah, I mean, if Yan can stay on her feet, this was a really fun fight.
Yeah, I think if she could stay on her feet, she could definitely put Zhang in trouble.
Yeah, Zhang is a fighter who, you know, it really seemed like when she was coming up and had that first fight with Joanna Jędrzejczyk.
Yep.
And, you know, she had that TKO over Jessica Andrade, and then she had the Jędrzejczyk fight. It was like, oh man, Weili Zhang is not only is she a physical force, but she can be a real buzzsaw as a striker. And just go after people. And I think Rose Namajunas was a course correction. Because Zhang has never been a great defensive fighter.
No.
She's always been a fighter who just sort of psychs herself up to eat whatever punishment is going to come at her and deliver her offense in the meantime.
Yeah.
And Rose Namajunas knocked her out. And what we've seen since then is a fighter who is very much more on the side of... She's much more now in the Valentina Shevchenko territory of like, okay, we can trade a little on the feet if I have a clear, wide open path to just landing something good.
Mm-hmm.
But most of what I want to do is tie up with you and take you down.
Yeah. Boy, this wrestling shit is easy, seems to be the... Yeah, I would call Zhang she's what I might call a proximity counterpuncher.
Yeah.
She's that... Because one of her defining characteristics, even in the Joanna fight, like the crazy thing is to look back at that and realize that, like, maybe Joanna could have just, like, outkicked her. And it would have been a much slower and less exciting fight, but... It was Joanna's own insistence on creating pocket exchanges while also not having great defense that made that fight so crazy, because it's almost entirely Zhang countering her.
Yeah.
And just lashing out with a two or three punch combination the moment Joanna like steps in to hit her. And that is really a through line in Zhang's entire UFC career, is that she does not like to lead. She does not like to initiate exchanges. And she often gets surprised by what is actually coming at her when she decides she's going to counter somebody. She just doesn't seem to have a lot of comfort in the pocket.
Yeah.
She's not very relaxed. And so, yeah, go on.
I would say it's a little surprising because her form is so solid.
Yeah.
On a lot of her kickboxing, that you like, usually when I think of fighters who just can't get comfortable striking, it's because they are they don't have enough skill to be able to navigate an exchange cleanly. With Zhang, I think it is really just a deep down, maybe even without a tendency to gallop at all, maybe even a bit of the Edson Barboza thing, where there is just sort of like, no matter how technical Edson Barboza ever gets, there is a version of him that just does not like having to trade a lot of strikes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is a little odd for me with Zhang, because, like I say, you watch her back in the Joanna fight and it's like, oh, yeah, she's going to keep like tuning this. And like she could just be somebody who goes out and punches with anybody and wins. If she just keeps getting her kickboxing, tightening up her kickboxing game.
Yeah.
But instead, it's become much more of a, she can hang and she's not going to just like get run over on the feet by anybody. But if she doesn't have to be there, she won't.
No, I mean, she also gets by because she has a really great specific preparation for her opponents, you know, sort of habitual techniques and attacks. So she does come in. I mean, she is, I think Zhang is very much, as a striker, what you would call a rote fighter.
Yeah. Yeah.
You drill some pattern recognition into her, and that is most of what she has to go on.
Yep.
So we're going to spend this camp practicing countering the lead right, because the opponent likes to throw that shot a lot. Mm-hmm. And we're going to come up with two or three good counters for that. And just pick one. It's probably going to be good. Like, it's a sort of very broad, safe approach to navigating the like hairiness of striking exchanges, but she does not have the ability to. She doesn't have the ability like Max Holloway in like round four against Calvin Kattar when he's been going crazy and Kattar starts to come back and then Holloway just starts slipping shots.
Mm-hmm.
Slip, roll. Like, she doesn't have the ability to feel the rhythm of an exchange.
Yeah.
I'm not saying she couldn't learn it, but I think she's pretty clearly it's one of those chicken or the egg things where it's does she not have the techniques or because she's not comfortable or is she not comfortable because she doesn't have the technical skill?
Yeah. And for me, I would say I feel like it's the former rather than the latter just because.
Yeah.
She seems like such a trainable fighter. You know?
Right. Yeah. And the fact that she can be coached around these problems shows how adaptable she really is.
Yeah. On the flip side, Zhao Nan, she is definitely, I mean, I think at heart, she's been training herself off of being a brawler for her whole career, I think. Mm-hmm. Like the whole long through line of what she is trying to do is not be a fighter who just goes absolutely ape on somebody trying to put them away or just, you know, overwhelm them with offense.
Right.
Always sort of a clawing back from that position. And she's getting there. She's getting to the point where, you know, like that win she had over Jessica Andrade, she was just picking strikes, making Andrade constantly have to walk in and deal with something until Andrade made big enough mistakes that she had to really pay for it. But we've also seen just that fighters who don't necessarily respect her or get in their head too much about fighting her and are just going to take a fight to her,
yep,
can pull her out of her game because it is, she doesn't want to be controlled.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't want to be taking it easy and making the right read and doing the right thing. She wants to be getting out there and getting into a firefight.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, that does make this Weili Zhang fight interesting because Zhang, as we've just been talking about, doesn't want to have that kind of firefight. But she is also very capable of just willing herself through it to make what she wants to have happen, happen.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that's wrestling. And that's something that can very well beat Yan Jianan. Or Jianan Yan, rather.
Mm-hmm.
I have to pick Weili Zhang in this case. She's the one time she got knocked out was a really slick head kick from Rose Namajunas. And while Yan Jianan has some tricky tools in her game, she is not usually able to land with that much force and clarity. She tends to get into positions where she's just firing combos over and over, trying to either assert her pace or drive you, keep you from asserting yours.
I think I would say she is very much developing into that kind of striker.
She is. I just don't trust it yet. Yes.
Yeah, no, I
think that's... Andrade is a fighter who, if you can do something slick to her, she will just kind of walk onto it over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, I thought she also did a really great job finding counter combinations against Marina Rodriguez. That was the first time I was like, oh, Yan Xianan is like really learning to box and counterpunch.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a bit of that against Mackenzie Dern. I mean, I think this is the real concern for her here. Aside from just the fact that, like, yeah, if Weili Zhang takes her down, she's just in trouble.
Yeah.
And Weili Zhang is going to take her down. Is the fact that against Mackenzie Dern, her striking suffered because of the grappling threat.
Yeah.
Against a much worse, albeit probably more aggressive, grappler, but a much worse takedown artist. Like, you know, there's a part in that fight where Mackenzie Dern like pulls guard and Yan Shannon gets out of it, and then Dern butt scoots after Yan, and she just backs straight up to the cage and gets entangled all over again. Uh-huh. Like, that's not the kind of decision making she made against Jessica Andrade when she was more just focused on the striking.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of decision making she had against Rodriguez. The fact that she was worried about what am I going to do if she gets a hold of me, like, messed up her quite good striking technique.
Yeah, like I say, I think that Hart, she's, you know, somebody who really started her career loving to brawl.
Yeah.
And so she knows that, like, if she gets tangled up with somebody like that, if somebody can really assert themselves on her, she's going to make bad reads.
Oh, yeah.
You know? She's going to make mistakes because she's going to start getting carried away. She's going to start trying to just fight her way through something tooth and nail. And
rush and
yeah.
You know, and panic, whether that's excitability or panic or a bit of both.
Yeah.
Which, again, also shows her improvement that the way she dealt with Mackenzie Dern on the ground, she was much calmer and more patient in bad positions. She needed to be to survive. Yeah. And that's not a quality she had in previous fights.
No, it's not. It's been a really revealing run for her, you know, honestly. Like, this is somebody who, back when she was beating Angela Hill and Siri Kondo and Viviane Pereira, it was like, okay, yeah, she, you know, if she's got a little size on her opponent and a little strength, she'll go out and have a brawl and she can win her way through it just on volume and willpower. But over time, you know, the Andrade fight and the Dern fight, it's much more like, okay, she's actually having to make some really good decisions.
Yeah.
Moment to moment to get through it. And
we're seeing a real flow to her striking now that she didn't have before. Like, you know, taking an angle, finding that right exact moment to plant your feet and throw a really hard shot. And then go back to defense. Like, we have really seen her mature over the last few years, and especially over the last couple years.
Yeah.
I think she has hit a new level, but Wei Li Sheng's going to wrestle her.
Yeah. And that's just really going to make everything hard. It's just going to make everything really difficult for her.
Yeah, that's really it, is the fact that Wei Li Sheng is a physical beast who is excellent on the ground and is just going to pretty obviously look for that as often as possible. Again, if for one reason or another she can't make that happen, and the mere threat of it doesn't have too deleterious an effect on Yan Xiaonan's boxing game, I think Wei Li Sheng could easily end up in trouble in this fight.
Yeah, I mean,
if this were a kickboxing match, she'd be in trouble. Yan Xiaonan is, I think, has quickly become that good and that dangerous.
Yeah, well, it's you know, I like the, personally, and maybe I'm overplaying, but I like the Shevchenko comparison for Zhang, where, like, there have been plenty of fights in Shevchenko's career where it's just like, the actual depth and danger of your striking game is not so much that this would be half as easy a fight if all you could do was strike.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that you're tying this, you know, that Shevchenko tied so much of her striking to clinch takedowns and top control, that then people had to deal with the striking on the terms of, I might also get taken down out of this.
Yeah.
There's no safe spot for me to tie up with Shevchenko.
Yeah.
If I don't like dealing with her speed and power. And Zhang, she's not, you know, she's also not as powerful as Shevchenko. So it really is something where she needs her takedown game to continue thriving at an elite level. She needs to be out wrestling somebody.
Yeah.
Otherwise, other good strikers are going to push her through a really difficult fight because she just kind of is a set it and forget it striker. Without a lot of defense. Odds on this fight, though.
Yeah, we're both picking Zhang, by the way. I'm not sure. I made that clear, but
we're both picking Wei Lei Zhang. She opened at -357. She's currently at -455. Yan Xiaonan opened at +261, is currently at +364. Like, I'm not saying the odds should be closer, but it does have to be said that Zhang got a lot of takedowns and control on Rose Namajunas in their second fight.
Yeah.
And did not win it.
I mean, Yan Xiaonan might just, like she did against Dern, just take a page out of Alex Pineda's book. Alex Pineda is not a good grappler or good wrestler.
No.
What's his approach to the ground? What happened when the much better and more experienced grappler Jan Blachowicz got him down?
Just
close guard, control posture, stay safe. Yep. You're gonna get to strike next round for a little bit.
Yep.
If Yan Xiaonan can pull off some kind of approach like that, which again she did a bit against Dern pretty well.
Yeah, she did.
She just stayed patient and safe and was like, all right, I guess I lost this round. Let's try again next time. You know?
There's room.
Having to take her down and control her for the better part of every round or finish her on the ground to beat her. I mean, that is the real problem, is that like Carla Esparza, Zhang is going to try to batter her from top position, but like where Mackenzie Dern didn't. Even so, there is an avenue here to just sort of let the grappling be a wash when it does happen, and otherwise try to avoid it at all costs and do as much striking as possible, where Yan Xiaonan has a pretty solid performance.
Yeah. Like I say, I'm not saying the odds have to be closer, but I am saying that this is not a lock fight for Wei Lei Zhang.
No.
All right. That brings us to the BMF title fight. Justin Gaethje, Max Holloway, and, you know, any time, honestly, before the most recent Dustin Poirier fight, I might have been sorely tempted to pick Max Holloway in this fight.
I'm still sorely tempted, but I know what you're saying. That I'm still sorely tempted because I don't know if that is actually indicative of a permanent maturation on Justin Gaethje's part. But I agree with what you're implying, that that was the most consistently technical and strategic striking performance we have ever seen out of Justin Gaethje.
It is the product of years of course correction. So it's not like it just came out of nowhere. This is something that we have seen Gaethje trying to modify out of his game maybe since Tony Ferguson in 2024. Slowly.
Since the two losses. I mean, I wrote this up for my Substack. I can literally read you the quotes if you give me just a moment.
Sure.
Just Justin Gaethje talked about this. He said,
Nothing. I was just going to fill space if you needed it.
No, he said, you know what changed me? Oh, sorry. First he said, I'm glad I lost twice. Yep. I needed that. I wasn't sure if it was broken when I fought Eddie. I found a lot of success. Dustin showed me what was broken. And I was able to go back to the drawing board. And at this level, you better do that or else, you know, you're going to get hit a lot more. And then he said, you know what changed me? I watched Yoel Romero fight. He didn't do nothing for like three rounds. Then he knocked the guy out and everyone went crazy. Trevor tried to tell me forever, you're trying too hard, man. I was like, what does that mean? Yeah. So he lost twice, realized very intelligently he had to reevaluate his game. He wasn't just going to be able to brawl with everyone. And then he watched nobody's idea of a consistent strategic fighter.
Yeah.
Somebody who at the very least has an abundance of patience.
Yep.
And was like, wait, you can still do... Because clearly, like, what that reveals is that what Justin Gaethje... His nickname isn't the highlight by accident.
No, yeah.
That is what drives him. What he wants to do is something incredible that gets the fans slavering and screaming and standing up out of their seats. He loves that reaction from the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also as a guy from a wrestling background, having a bunch of like, what are wrestling matches? Are they 6 minutes, 9 minutes?
Oh, I don't even know.
I think they're 6 minutes. No energy, really, like no energy conservation required.
Yeah.
Full tilt, like you just go. And
three periods, 7 minutes total.
Okay. I'm sure there's a bunch of different rule sets with different, but yeah, it's short is the point. And you can just kind of put it all out there and hold nothing back in a way that you can't in a potentially 25 minute long MMA fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that with that as his background and just a deep seated desire to thrill the fans. The reason I think Justin Gaethje latched onto Yoel Romero was like, man, this guy, people think this guy's exciting, even though he doesn't do anything for most of the fight.
Yeah.
And that's what you see in the Tony Ferguson fight. That was the first time we saw this like new approach from Gaethje. Mm-hmm. And it is a very limited idea of what counterpunching is.
Yep.
In some ways, a parallel to Weili Zhang's, what I said about Zhang's fight with Ioane Janjacek, mm-hmm. where like he just had an opponent who was going to continually keep giving him counters no matter what.
Yeah.
And that was what enabled him to look so impressive, because all he had to do was wait for him to walk in. What I will say is that in round five of that fight, because clearly Whitman had been trying to teach him this shit all along and still is.
Yeah.
Round five of that fight, Whitman finally got him to jab.
Mm-hmm.
And he crushed Tony Ferguson at that point. He was already, Tony was in a bad way, but he was not even close to being in the fight or in any of the exchanges in round five because Justin found his jab. This is a phenomenon which has reoccurred three times in Justin Gaethje's UFC career. Rafael Fiziev and Michael Chandler, two other fights where it's a better version of counterpuncher Gaethje than you saw against Ferguson.
Yeah.
More sophisticated, better defense, tighter combination punching, more body shots, things like that. But still in both of those fights, he doesn't think to jab until the last round, at which point he starts to dominate.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a Piddle on Twitter, PDL MMA, he has been gunning for the nickname The Violence Idiot to stick.
Uh-huh.
It might be too late for that now if that Dustin Poirier rematch really is indicative of a final maturation, but Justin Gaethje really is the violent idiot. Like,
yeah,
he just wants to do crazy, exciting shit. It doesn't occur to him to simply win the fight until he's like really tired. Right?
Yeah, it is the most MMA thing ever for a fighter to spend their whole career fighting one very specific way and then watch somebody who cannot, should not, and just is definitely like unrecreatable.
Yeah, you should not try to emulate Yoel Romero.
Unimitable. Inimitable. There we go.
Inimicable.
Inimicable. That's the word I'm looking for. And to look at that dude and be like, I'm going to do that. Like, no. No, you're not. Never. But, and this is, you know, a credit, I think, to, it's probably like one of those perfect marriage of minds kind of thing.
Yes.
Where we've seen Rose Namajunas and what Trevor Whitman's attempts and style has done with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels in some ways like it's taken a lot out of her game. It's taken a lot of the edge off of her game over time.
Yeah.
And there was a moment, there was a brief time in Gaethje's career where that also seemed to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think Gaethje has it in him to actually let that happen.
No.
So now instead you just have a balance where like
mm-hmm.
he's not taking as many big risks. he's not just doing as much dumb chuck it and hope and like hope kind of fighting, or, you know, make you eat my fist, I don't care what you do kind of fighting. But he's still really violent and not passing up opportunities when he gets them. And for like that, that makes somebody like Justin Gaethje really hard to beat.
Yeah, you can imagine Trevor Whitman's reaction when Justin came to him was like, I finally get what you've been saying all these years. You want me to fight like Yoel Romero. And Trevor Whitman must have like turned his back to hide his facial expression.
Yeah.
Taken a deep breath and then thought, I can work with this.
Yeah.
You know what?
Better than nothing.
I'm teaching a child. Like, yes. Maybe that's the thing. Trevor Whitman is an actual boxing coach. He has coached good boxers. And maybe the phenomenon where a bunch of Trevor Whitman's fighters become MMA fighters, become too passive, is not fully his fault. It's that he's trying to teach this principled way of fighting to people who are, at the end of the day, MMA fighters.
Yeah, absolute savages.
And they can't help but overcorrect. Like, oh, so he's like, yeah, what I want you to do is control the fight positionally. Use your jab. Like, don't give anything away. Like, I see. What he wants me to do is nothing.
Yeah.
Do less. I get it, Trevor. And he's like, no. But
yeah,
I think it has been a slow process. And if that Poirier fight again, if that is an indication of something that we will see from Gaethje going forward, it has yielded incredible results, because that was a fantastic performance. It still had all the Gaethje-ness you could ever ask for. You can't train that out of him. He's still throwing absolute hammers right off the bat.
Yep.
He is still getting into crazy exchanges, but the combinations are quite intelligent. The defense is routinely there, even if some of it is awkward and weird, and it routinely leads to more offense. And there's just a much more sophisticated understanding of like how to set traps, how to walk people into certain strikes, how to kind of stay flexible and not be so single-minded.
Well, and so the big thing for me too with this is, like I say, if it were any time before that Poirier fight, I would be much more sorely tempted to pick Holloway, because you have Gaethje Classic, who would just kind of go after people no matter what all the time. And you either got broken and overwhelmed, or you fought through it and found opportunities, because there were always tons of opportunities.
That version might have been harder for Holloway, just because Holloway is a featherweight.
Yeah, maybe.
Is he just flinging himself? I mean, Holloway's not at his best on the back foot.
No, it's true. It is true. But I also think that Holloway probably would have had the footwork to make that work.
Yeah.
Maybe. And then you had your, you know, Chandler, Fiziev.
82.0, the Ferguson.
82.0.
Ferguson through Fiziev. Maybe through Chandler, I would say, was that kind of era, really.
Ferguson through Fiziev, I'll say Fiziev, where he is trying to figure out how to stay safe and take the edge off of his game and to be more of an out fighter and more of a counter puncher.
Yeah.
And if there was going to be a lot large spaces, large points of empty space, I would be very likely to pick Holloway to fill that foot race. It maybe it hurt a couple times, but just
because like I said before, it's a style that invites pressure and gives away a lot of initiative. And the two opponents, granted, helped by a serious grappling threat, both of them.
Yeah.
But the two opponents who have simply sort of accepted the gambit fully.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're going to let me come forward? Great. They have made Justin Gaethje miserably uncomfortable.
Yeah. But in the Poirier fight, what we saw was Poirier would come forward and Gaethje would hit him with something on the counter, maybe eat a shot in the process. And Poirier would back up and do that thing he does where he looks to set the trap on the back foot. And Gagey would pursue for two or three strikes, keeping his feet under him, and then stop and make Poirier have to come forward again.
Mm-hmm.
And Max Hall, that to me smacks a great deal of Holloway Volkanovski and Holloway Poirier.
Yeah. Holloway Poirier, really. I mean, he doesn't, Justin, like I said, he doesn't have Volkanovski's jab.
He doesn't have Volkanovski's jab.
And calm, positional adjusting style of.
But a lot of the, well, a lot, especially maybe like Volkanovski one or two. A lot of what made those fights really difficult for Holloway, not beyond the jab, was the constantly coiled threat of the counter.
Yeah.
Where Holloway had to step in, because he's always a fighter who tries to build through volume. You know, simple jab upstairs, jab cross, start jabbing to the body, start getting you guessing where he's going, up or down, and then start lacing in more hard punches behind that until he's just constantly flurrying on you. But with fighters who had the power and the wherewithal to keep controlled and be able to throw powerful counter shots,
mm-hmm.
Holloway would basically have to walk into those over and over again and reset all the time and never build the momentum and constantly be toying with the first layer of his building, of his pressure building style.
Yeah.
And that's what Gagey looks like right now, is he looks like a fighter who can do that.
Yep.
So I got to pick him, you know?
Yeah, I will tell you right now, my gut says Justin Gagey.
Yeah.
Because Max Holloway has made one other attempt to go to lightweight. I don't think the fact that he was a smaller man fighting a big lightweight puncher was the entirety of that Poirier fight, not by a long shot.
No.
But it was clearly a factor. It's the most I've ever seen Max Holloway hurt.
Max Holloway, for all of his featherweight greatness, has never, ever been a big puncher.
I think Max is a bigger puncher than he's given credit for. I think he's like Tony Ferguson. Like, people didn't think of Tony as a big puncher either, but Max hurts people in every fight. Like,
he hurts people because he always puts together strikes, and he's sharp with his combinations, he's sharp with his targets, that eventually you're gonna get surprised.
Like, yeah. Anybody, it's the timing, it's the but yeah, I think it's a mistake just to think that Max Holloway is like, he's not feather fisted.
He's not feather fisted.
You can't just eat his shots. He will hurt you.
But he doesn't knock anybody out.
Yeah, not almost ever. Not except it's old Chan Sung Jung or whatever, and he literally runs into the punch. Yeah, he's not Justin Gaethje or Dustin Poirier.
Yeah.
With that just thudding power, of course.
And that is a big, that did play a big factor against Poirier, where like he would get some real success and hurt Poirier a bit and back him up and all that. But then Poirier could just walk him on to one or two shots that forced Holloway to have to totally reset and start his game over.
Yeah. So there's that. That's a concern for Holloway moving back up to 155 again. And granted, he's had a full camp this time. He looks to have packed on a little muscle. Maybe his preparation's been better. As I recall, the Poirier fight was kind of rushed.
Yeah, he said it was 6 weeks instead of eight.
Yeah.
So not nothing, but yeah.
So, but that's a reason that my gut says Gaethje. The fact that I fully agree. I was immensely impressed with Gaethje against Poirier. That was a fight. It was so like tactically sharp and interesting. I said this at the time. The highest praise I can give a fight like that is that I was sad when somebody got knocked out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just wanted to see more of it. It was such an interesting, high-level fight from both those guys.
Yeah.
It really felt like Gaethje finally reaching the level that Poirier has like been at for several years.
We know Poirier's, he's at his defensive worst on the front foot, which is why he's built a whole game about like stepping in with hard exchanges and teasing hard exchanges that draw him back, where he can draw back and you start to pursue, and he can be a much better puncher off the back foot that you don't expect. I mean, he's a very tactical fighter in a way that Gaethje has never had, never in the previous past tried to be.
But I mean, this was a fight where both guys were drawing shots out of each other. They were both initiating and then defending and recountering. And it was just a real chess match of a fight, to forgive the tired analogy, but like that is how it was feeling.
An actual chess match, because it's not necessarily the slowest thing you've ever seen in your life.
It was bullet chess. Artillery shell chess, since it was Poirier and Gaethje. So that's another factor. And then the other thing is Max's potential decline. Which I'm not certain of yet. Because there have been fights previously in Max Holloway's career where he has not been the guy you think of as Max Holloway. When he fought Frankie Edgar. When he fought Jeremy Stephens. These were early career, mid legendary run to the title era Max Holloway performances, which were like a little staid, mostly on the back foot, not steadily building this avalanche of volume. And then we had him trying to adjust his approach in like the Volkanovski rematch, the first one. But then right after that was Calvin Kattar. Which is the most Max Holloway fight ever. And I've now rewatched that fight like three times, and it's, my God, it's an incredible, incredible performance from Max Holloway. And then, but then you have him getting destroyed by Volkanovski in the trilogy fight. And then maybe you get a little, another sort of return of anti-volume Max Holloway against Arnold Allen. I think you saw him recapture the classic form a bit against Chan Sung Jung, but it's also a fight where he got shaken up by punches a few times. And I think there is just this feeling, I can't be sure, but there's this feeling that Max Holloway is feeling shots more than he used to.
I mean, he is a prime candidate to get old before he should.
Absolutely. I mean, look at his fights with Jose Aldo. Like, he literally just made a decision to tank shots from one of the hardest hitters in featherweight history. Because he's like, I can take these for as long as you can dish them out, which will not be more than two rounds. And he's, if I keep making you dish them out, I'm happy to eat them as long as I have to, because it will lead to you destroying yourself. That was the one of the ballsiest strategic decisions imaginable. And it worked twice. And it did result in him, just eating a shitload of punishment. And against Chan Sung Jung, it's like, I whether he's like actually getting badly hurt or he just doesn't want that kind of thing to happen anymore because he's older, he's wiser, he realizes that's like a serious cost to just willingly spend, I don't know. If that, if the Calvin Kattar fight hadn't come right smack in the middle of like the Volkanovski series and only 3 years ago, I think I'd be a lot more convinced that there's a downward trend.
I'm not going to write anything off with Max Holloway until I really see it happen. He's also got a style that I think he can modify enough to be a effective top-level fighter for a lot longer than somebody like Tony Ferguson.
I mean, look at that second Volkanovski fight. It was a whole new game, and maybe it didn't maybe it had a problem that a lot of like massive type adjustments like that do, where he couldn't quite stick to it for five rounds, but man, he found some really incredible ideas that for Max Holloway were very unorthodox. So all of those are the reasons, I think, if I could put reason, apply reason to a gut judgment, why my gut says Justin Gaethje. But my head, which is usually wrong, has decided to pick Max Holloway.
Oh, well, there you go.
I've already picked him on my show, so I gotta pick him.
Yeah, you gotta ride with it. All right.
Well, hold on. Let me very quickly. We're doing something very quickly.
Okay, I'll set a timer for 10 minutes. That should.
That's fine. That's that's probably more time than I need. The reasons for picking Max Holloway, right?
Yeah.
Is that all the brilliance we saw to Justin Gaethje against Dustin Poirier, as you yourself just said, Dustin Poirier is not the fighter to test Justin Gaethje with actual swarming pressure.
Yeah, no, he likes to step forward and step back because he gets hurt
right.
whenever he goes forward.
The last two times we saw Justin Gaethje fight somebody with insane pressure, yes, they were also grapplers, but yep. he put himself in some really awkward positions against both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And he lost control of himself. All the maturity he had been building all that time, like, just consider the fact that the Chandler and Fiziev fights, like the Fiziev fight and the Chandler fight, those are kind of a type. The Chuck Yalos fight's right in the middle there. It's yeah. right between them. The Tony Ferguson fight, the transformative Tony Ferguson fight, is immediately preceding the Khabib fight.
Yeah.
It's a real style dependent thing that Justin Gaethje has developed. And I'm not yet ready to think for sure that a really sophisticated showing against Dustin Poirier proves that if somebody can once again just pile it on, he is not going to actually get uncomfortable and realize he's bitten off more than he can chew.
Yeah, no, it's fair. Like I say, if it were any time before this Poirier fight,
yeah, yeah,
I would be like right there, just be like, oh man, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because Gaethje is so much less suited, or was in the past, to deal with pressure than Poirier was when Max Holloway fought him.
Yeah. And if we think about the things that are always effective against Justin Gaethje, including it up to the Fiziev fight, drawing out his defense, drawing him into a high guard or a shell,
yeah.
and then hitting him with layered attacks, massively long combinations coming from every angle, nobody does that better than Max Holloway.
No, that's true. If he can get his momentum going, if Max Holloway can build for a round or two, then
yeah,
it is very likely that he just starts to run away with the whole fight.
And I think that whatever approach Max comes into this fight with, he will end up pressuring the hell out of Justin Gaethje for the simple reason that otherwise Gaethje is going to smash him with low kicks.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is something that Max has been susceptible to. But he was susceptible to them in, for example, the Yair Rodriguez fight, a fight where he started out trying to be like new school Max.
Yeah.
And then he got low kicked a bunch. He's like, all right, fuck this. I'm going to run this guy over.
Yep.
And
it's never been the poison that defeats Max Holloway.
No, exactly. He will adjust, and he will adjust with his typical approach, overwhelming, grabbing initiative and never letting it go. So I think there's a real intellectual case to be made for Max Holloway being actually a very tough style matchup for Justin Gaethje. It's all the other sort of X factors that inform the gut pick that I would like to make, but I've already picked Max, so I'm doing it again.
Gaethje opened at -213, got down as low as -242. It's currently up at -152. Holloway opened at +163, got up as high as +203. Is currently down at +137. All right, that brings us to Charles Oliveira, Armand Tsarukyan. And there's a very good chance that this could be a bad fight for Armand Tsarukyan.
Sure.
I'll say that. He had that fight not long ago, just in fact, middle of last year, just 8 months ago. He had that fight with Joakim Silva.
Yeah.
Where... despite getting takedowns, despite a lot of physical dominance, despite some striking and pressure dominance, he got badly shook up by Joakim Silva.
It was definitely a fight where he was trying to flex his striking skill.
Yes.
And he paid for it.
And he paid for it. And if he pays for it against Charles Oliveira, Charles Oliveira is much more capable of turning your one moment of error into him finishing you 2 seconds later.
Yep.
He does not let people off the hook if they get hurt against him.
Yep.
Otherwise, though, from what we have seen from Charles Oliveira against Islam Makhachev and even Benil Dariush.
And Paul Felder against top position grapplers.
And Paul Felder.
Mm-hmm.
there is just a very quick avenue where this fight starts bad and stays bad for Charles Oliveira.
Saryukin
has been looking like a much more, I think he's gotten to a point where he knows that he needs to be the bull. Mm-hmm. That he can't just, like, he can't have that fight that he had with Mateusz Gamrot.
Right.
And he is comfortable and confident enough in his striking at this point, sometimes to a fault, that he needs to just go out there, put hands on people, tie them up, and force them into his fight.
Yeah.
And that he can outlast them, he can outfight them doing that fight, having that fight, and that is just what he should trust. And if he does that, I mean, he's going to put Charles Oliveira on his back. Charles Oliveira is a great offensive wrestler, but he's always been a willing guard grappler.
Mm-hmm.
And he can get out positioned immediately being a willing guard grappler.
Yeah.
In a
really reductive way, but in a way that is true, I think. The secret sauce against Charles Oliveira is simply not being afraid to get on top of him.
Yeah. Just, he will give up top half guard immediately if you go after it and take it.
Yeah.
You know? And if you can then take advantage of that position, you can take Charles Oliveira out.
Yeah.
And if you have the ability to make that kind of position a problem and you do not back down from Oliveira, you can also, as we saw against Islam Makhachev, you can outpunch him too. Because it's not like he's a defensive master striking. You know?
Yeah.
So I think Armand Saryukin is just in the right place at the right time to beat Charles Oliveira. But if he gets cute at any point, like, Beneil Dariush got Oliveira down right away and got on top of him. And he let Oliveira get back to his feet. He wasn't willing to create enough and be aggressive enough once he got that position, or couldn't hold it well enough.
Yep.
And then suddenly he became quickly overawed by the pressure coming at him. And that was that.
Yep.
So I think Saryukin can take care of himself better than that. But you've got to be willing to just go after Oliveira and have no fear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always going to be a bit of a gambit, you know. It's always Charles Oliveira basically makes you have a one round fight, or be willing to have a one round fight.
Yep.
Or you're gonna lose. That's kind of the Charles Oliveira thing. It's like, are you willing to just go totally balls out against this guy?
Yep.
And risk everything? No, then you're probably gonna lose. So I'm picking Saryukin, but you know, it'll be a thriller. It'll be fantastic.
Oh yeah. No question about that. Yeah, I gotta side with you. In fact, I don't really have too much to add. I mean, obviously, Charles Oliveira, if Saryukin lets him put on pressure, if Saryukin spends too much time striking with him, if he gets his back put up against the fence, like, yeah, he's gonna get chances to hit Charles, and he's gonna get punished as long as Charles remains standing.
Uh-huh.
Because Charles is one of the best in the world at, like, extending the exchanges.
Yeah.
And following up and chasing you back out of the pocket. Like, the kind of fight that Alexander Hernandez always loses, that's what Charles Oliveira does to people who are not Alexander Hernandez.
Yeah, it's what he does to Justin Gaethje.
Exactly, yeah. Gaethje, who gets tricked into throwing the goofiest, most overthrown punches imaginable, and then does this so often and so wildly that he gets his feet, it's like heels are touching, and Charles hits him with a right hand when he thinks he's safe and crushes him.
Yeah.
But Justin Gaethje had a lot of opportunities to get on top of Charles Oliveira in that fight. He knocked mm-hmm. him down multiple times, and he simply didn't want to do it.
Yep.
And I just don't think Sorokin's going to have that problem. He has been perfectly willing to grapple with tons of amazing grapplers already. And somebody who actually is happy to play guard, that doesn't sound like Damir Ismagulov. That doesn't sound like Islam Makhachev. The opponent it sounds most like is Joel Alvarez.
Yeah.
Whom he obliterated from top position. I mean, this is the real problem. It's not just that is Sorokin a good takedown artist and a willing top position grappler, which he is both. It's, is he willing to smash you with strikes from top position? And can he do it, unlike Benil Dariush, can he do it without having to like posture up and try to throw crazy knockout blows? Can he just stay close and crush you with short shots? Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, so, that's really it.
Yep, I'm picking Sorokin as well. And I'm happy to see him finally getting what looks like a breakthrough fight that should set him up for a title shot.
Definitely.
It's been a long time coming. I don't think it's been too long a time coming, honestly, all things considered.
No, he seems like he's right now at like that. Yep. His last couple of fights, he seems like a fighter right now at his pinnacle.
And that's, he has basically just entered his prime or just been in it for a short time. He's 27 years old. Perfect timing for him to break through.
Yep. Oliveira opened at plus 150, is currently at plus 198. Sorokin opened at minus 192, is currently at minus 226. Yeah, I get it. It just reads like a very tough fight for Oliveira.
Yep.
That brings us finally our final bout of the main card.
Finally.
Bo Nickel, Cody Brundage.
What the hell is this doing here?
I mean, it is here for one very obvious reason. It is a completely set up, while also being the hardest fight he's had to date, I should say.
Yep.
But it is completely set up for Nickel to just crush Brundage and to do it as a big lead in to the rest of the card. And to get hype on a guy that the UFC is clearly already paying a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that I think people are missing with Bo Nickel, is that
they've invested and they need their pay up quick.
Yes. When the UFC gets somebody like him, when they get a Greg Hardy, I hate to put that on Bo Nickel, but it's the same thing. When they get a Greg Hardy, every Greg Hardy fight was a main card fight.
Yep.
You know, they're spending probably 80 to 100K win show or show win money on Nickel out of the gate.
For a 5-0 fighter, you don't get a soft touch when you cost that much.
Yeah. Or at the very least, even if you're getting soft touches, which Nickel has been, you need to be doing it on a big enough stage that they can immediately build stuff out of you.
Yeah.
And so that's what they're doing. And that's what this is. And I have a small soft spot for Brundage.
Because you have a soft spot right on the top of your skull.
Because I really do think that for a guy with no inherent deep skill at all, even as a wrestler, even as a former collegiate wrestler, his wrestling is very rote and basic. For a guy with no single deep skill to him at all, I think he does honestly try to come out and have a single plan in mind for how to approach a fight.
Yeah.
But he just walks himself into the most obvious stuff imaginable.
Yeah.
Misses a dude who let Cedriquis Dumas out-wrestle him.
Yeah.
Like, he is going to have one plan for Nickel, which is more than anybody else has had. Everybody else has just stood in front of Bo Nickel and let him tee off on them.
Jamie Pickett, the most experienced opponent, but that is a planless fighter if ever I've seen one.
Yeah. And everybody else is just every fighter he's had has just been wide-eyed in front of him, waiting to be run over and terrified of being on his highlight reel.
Yep.
Brundage won't be that, but he very well might jump guillotine And end up on his back trying to play from guard.
Yeah, there's a couple instincts that Brundage can't get away from, which often end up screwing him. And then there's one thing that is not an instinct that he prepares for each. But you like him because he is like the quintessential MMA game planner.
Yeah.
Like, it's all the one, like, overcorrection.
Yes.
This is what I'm going to do. There's no flexibility. There's no, like, there's no ability to adapt or build on that. There's not enough skill there.
No. It is a base archetype for teaching people about how different MMA games function. If you want to look at what a game planner looks like, you can watch Cody Brundage and understand, like, oh, I am seeing he is the reason other fighters talk about not game planning and not watching tape and letting their coach do all the thinking for them.
Right.
It is pulling jumping guillotine on Cedricus Dumas and getting out wrestled.
He's a thinking man of the kind that like a thinking man whose favorite podcast is the Joe Rogan Experience.
Yes.
Not actually purely inquisitive as he thinks.
No.
Tricks himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bo Nickel.
Yeah, you got to pick Bo Nickel. That's really all there is to it.
Yep.
And but is it, you know what? It is a step up. Brundage will bring more to the table unquestionably than Val Woodburn or Jamie Pickett.
Yep.
He will. He is not easily cowed. He is not immediately shaken off of a fight.
Yep.
You actually have to go out and beat him. It's not that hard, but you know, you do have to actually be able to handle what he brings to you, essentially, which nobody else who has fought Bo Nickel can say that.
Yeah.
Odds on the fight. Nickel is opened at -1429, is currently at -2222. And Brundage opened at +714, is currently at +910.
Nobody in Bo Nickel's position should ever be favored that heavily.
No. Bo Nickel, it has to be said, right now, he is in pure Aaron Pico territory.
Oh, yeah. With less of these skills that Aaron Pico came in with.
Yeah, without the gold gloves boxing.
Yep.
He is in pure Aaron Pico territory, and that is a hype train that is ripe for derailment, you know?
Yep.
UFC is pushing him hard and fast. If he wins this fight, he will probably get somebody like Marc-Andre Barrio Junyoung Park you know, somebody in that kind of realm where it's like, okay, Eric Anders.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Where it's like, this is still a very winnable fight, but these are now people who actually have like either the physicality to match you or enough skill set and enough danger that you are really going to be, you know, it's like they had Greg Hardy win like 5 fights and then they put him in against Alexander Volkov.
Right.
And it's just like the mile of difference between fighting Justin Taffa or somebody like that and Alexander Volkov. Nickel will run straight into that, and the Chris Weidmans and the John Joneses of the world are not only few and far between, but it may be something that doesn't exist in modern MMA anymore.
Yeah.
You know? I guess Alex Pereira would be the guy that has done that, and that speaks more, or Israel Adesanya, and that speaks more to how striking-centered the modern MMA meta is. Like, how far does Nickel go up the ladder before he can't actually out-wrestle somebody?
Right.
Because it might not be that far.
Yep.
You know?
And if he cannot wrestle somebody, he's not getting very far with his current level of striking skill.
Yeah.
Tell you that much. So I know we knocked a dude out, people, but With an overthrown punch with no setup, which was purely based on the fact that he's really fast and powerful, and his opponent was trash.
His opponent was a 5'8" middleweight who has since dropped to welterweight and got run over by a terrible athlete in Obon Elliott.
Yeah.
Like, that means nothing.
These are not meaningful results. They're valuable experience for a guy like Bo Nickel, but it's not a lot of experience, is it?
It is pure Abus Magomedov. That win is pure Abus Magomedov territory.
Yeah.
With his big knockout that saw them put him in there with Sean Strickland.
Right.
You know.
Or who was the heavyweight who fought Jairzinho Rozenstruik?
Yeah. Gazeev, yep. So Brundage is not that. This is still the low end. Yeah. But they are warming Nickel up for that kind of test, and it'll be fascinating to see what happens when he takes it.
Mm-hmm.
To access the bonus content of this episode, you must be a paid subscriber. To do that, go to themmadrawpodcast.substack.com and subscribe today.